Welcome to Off Court, the business of sport podcast, where business and sports culture meet. Let's go. Kick it off, Robbie.
Hello and welcome to the Off Court podcast. I'm joined today by Patrick Psotka, who is the founder of Sparks Underwear. And I wanted to get Patrick on the podcast today for a couple of reasons. But look, first and foremost, he's got a really cool business, which I think people are going to be interested in. It's an e-commerce business, but I'll let him tell you about it. And the other reason I wanted to get Patrick on was he gave me a call the other day in regards to working with athletes and working in the sports realm, if you will, in regards to brand. So I thought that that would also be a really good topic of discussion for a sports and business podcast. So welcome, Patrick.
Happy to be on.
How you doing? We're getting some nice weather at the moment. You're in Bondi, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm in Bondi. Been in Bondi for the last 2 years, but originally when I first came, I'm originally Canadian, and when I first came to Australia, I was in Melbourne. So I spent 2 years in Melbourne. So it's interesting to see the difference in the culture between Melbourne and Sydney.
Go on, give it to us. Tell us straight.
Melbourne, I found Melbourne to be like a lot more friendly, a lot more easy to meet people when I first moved there. Sydney has a little bit more of a reputation of people aren't quite as open, I guess is the polite way to say it.
Yeah, that's interesting because, look, I haven't lived in Sydney. I have to say, I think there's a bit of... I think it depends where you go as well. I mean, Bondi is obviously on the other
end. Yeah, the eastern suburbs is definitely a microcosm.
Yeah, for sure. But I think certain parts of Melbourne definitely have a bit of pretentiousness about it. But we won't get into the Melbourne-Sydney debate because we could go on for days. But look, give us a bit of a background into your story in the business because it is an interesting one. And, you know, I think we've kind of spoken on and off a few years, just kind of sharing some ideas and tips and so forth. So yeah, it's been interesting for me to kind of see it grow from, you know, really an idea. And, you know, I hope you don't take offense to this, but probably you were in the position that a lot of people were in as far as trying to get into e-commerce and, you know, not necessarily breaking through, but certainly now it's kind of got to that point where, you know, you're looking at significant scaling. You know, just off air, we were talking about another one of your expansion projects coming up, which you can choose to talk about or not. It's up to you. But yeah, so it's been interesting for me to kind of see the growth of the brand to a point where, like, this is a legitimate, scalable brand with a significant customer base. So yeah, as I said, it's been really cool to see it. But please tell us your insight and the story of it.
Yeah, I guess we'll start from the beginning, which started in university. So I did a business degree back home in Canada, in the University of Victoria, and I specialized in entrepreneurship. And during that specialization, we did a semester-long project where we basically had to develop a business plan. That was pretty much the semester. You develop a business plan and you pitch the plan at the end of the semester. And through that semester, we looked, me and a couple of friends looked at starting a men's underwear company in Canada. And we went through that semester, developed a pretty good business plan. We pitched it at the end of the semester. We ended up placing very well in the competition. We got second place. And at that point, after the semester ended, I had to do an internship. So I thought, I didn't have any work experience at the time, but what I did have was I had something that I've worked on for the last 5 months, and I had a pretty good understanding of the men's underwear market in Canada at the time. So I thought, this is in lieu of not having work experience, maybe I can use this to my advantage in order to get an internship, which I needed in order to graduate. So I went, ended up DMing one of the men's underwear companies in Canada's CEO, ended up getting an interview with them, and ended up actually working for them for 5 months. And I basically just, pitched them what I'd been working on, sort of my understanding of the market. And yeah, I did a 5 month internship there. And at that point, I had to go on an exchange, and I always really wanted to do my own thing. And when I was trying to pick a destination for my exchange semester, most of my friends were going off to Europe, doing the whole Euro trip, having a good time. And I thought, well, if I'm serious about starting a men's underwear company, then probably the best place to go is to China, because that's where, you know, as you know, a lot of the garment manufacturing happens. So I went to China, started networking and trying to find a factory that would be able to produce like high quality men's underwear. And yeah, that was sort of the very start of Sparks. The underwear is quite unique. It's not just your standard pair of underwear. The inside of the underwear has a pouch, and it sort of separates. We call it the Kanga pouch. and it separates the joeys from the legs. So it allows for a little bit more airflow, keeps things cooler. You're not hanging to the left or the right. Everything's front and center. So that's sort of the point of differentiation on the product. And that was the early days of Sparks. That was sort of like from the idea to actually having a prototype in the hand. That was sort of where things started.
For sure. And I think, you know, it's probably a really typical story, right, of having that idea. And then, you know, probably the one point of difference is I think a lot of people don't go straight to the source straight away. I think that's a big mistake people make, where they don't actually know who they're dealing with for a little while until they actually get over there.
They try and go on Alibaba. And Alibaba has its place, but if you really want to build a relationship with your supplier, it's much better just to go there in person and meet them. And you get a lot further rather than trying to go back and forth online. It shows that you're serious and you can really build that personal connection, because China and their culture, it's so important having that strong relationship. So yeah, I would definitely recommend going to meet your partners, because they're the most important part of any e-commerce business is your supplier.
Definitely. And it's obviously a lot harder now at the moment with COVID, but that aside, when borders are open and starts, it's reasonably cheap to get over there as well. You don't have to spend a lot of money. It's not like a round the world trip. You know, I've seen people literally do it in a day.
I've seen you go over to a lot of the fairs over there.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I've really missed that in the last 2 years. And, you know, I think it's something I've said it before and I would really recommend to everyone is, even if you don't really have a good idea of the exact thing that you want to do, but you know you want to do something in the space, going to those trade fairs, those sourcing fairs, honestly, I come back with like notebooks of ideas, like literally, like I have them stored away. Because what happens is you go through, like, you know, even I'm not even talking about new businesses, you go through and you're like, why couldn't we do a spin-off product for a slightly different market? Why can't we do, you know, if you're underwear, why can't we do one specifically for sport? Or maybe it's, we got specific underwear for swimming, I don't know. But you just come away with those ideas that you wouldn't otherwise have. So thoroughly, and you know, particularly recommend that for people who are interested. Even if you're at the start of the journey, as I said, it doesn't cost a lot to get over there. I think most of the fares are free anyway, so you just got to pay for your airfare to get over.
I think the good thing about going to one of those fairs, because I've went to fairs in Australia, is you really do find like higher quality factories, because they have to pay a lot of money to go to these fairs. So you tend to find, at least in my experience, higher quality factories than you would when you're just going on Alibaba. I feel like if you go on Alibaba, it's, you know, throwing a dart blind at a board and just hoping to hit a bullseye. But when you go to a fair, you're definitely interacting with higher quality factors than you normally would.
Definitely. And talk to me about the difference in the underwear market in Australia compared to Canada, because obviously, you know, the underwear market in Australia is dominated by, say, Bonds and maybe a couple of other major brands. So there's certainly particular categories, product categories that are dominated by a small number of massive brands that are kind of ripe for not necessarily disruption, but ripe for niche.
A new brand, yeah, a new brand coming in. That actually sort of brings me to the second journey or second chapter of Sparks. And after I went to China and find a supplier, I decided to go backpacking through Southeast Asia. And I was in the Philippines and I met these two Aussie blokes, top-notch guys. I ended up traveling with them for 2 weeks in the Philippines. And while I was, you know, traveling with them, you know, I told them the idea about that I wanted to start a men's underwear company. I think that is also something that I do a lot, is I always talk to people about my ideas, because you never know who might be able to help you or, you know, where a conversation can lead. So I was always very open about my ideas. I never kept my cards too close to my chest. So I was talking to them about the men's underwear market in Australia. And they said, you know, if you're a guy in Australia, 75% chance you're either wearing Bonds or Calvin Klein. And outside of that, there's other brands, but it's nowhere near as competitive as it is back home in North America, the US, Canada. There's a lot more brands playing in that space over there. So when I went and looked at Bonds and Calvin Klein, and I checked out the Bonds website, I definitely saw a gap in the market to bring, you know, a product that was different than what was currently on the market. And the more I thought about like how I could make it Australian with the Kanga pouch and the Joeys, like everything's just started to make sense. And I think Australia is a great market to enter into if you're looking to get into e-commerce and sort of use it as a smoke test, because there is less competition over here just due to the size of the market compared to somewhere like the US. So I think it's a good ecosystem to really test out an idea and see if it has legs. Through that conversation, I decided that it was, you know, probably a good move to come to Australia and really see if I could make this idea work. And that brought me to Melbourne.
Awesome. And yeah, on the market thing, I've thought numerous times, oh, I wish I was born in the US or Canada or Europe or something with huge markets, which you obviously know back to front, which is a lot easier to launch in. But then again, it is, as you said, Australia is a very, I wouldn't say an easy market, but it's certainly a more accessible market where it's not like so saturated, and a smaller population where it's probably easier to reach your target audience.
I would say Australia too has a really good reputation overseas. Like if you look at companies like Bondi Boost, they're actually based in Melbourne. They have a great rep. Like there's an idea of like Australia with beautiful beaches, and it's something that sells overseas. And I think there's a lot of Australian brands that test a product and achieve some success, and then they go overseas and they really leverage the fact that they're Australian in their marketing. So I think a Bondi Boost is a perfect example of an Aussie company that really like utilizes that Australian marketing in overseas markets. So that would be one of the like plus sides of starting a business in Australia, is overseas markets tend to like them.
For sure. I think anything to do with like the image of Australian beaches or like the environment there's a story a year or two ago about an Australian company selling Australian air. They packaged up Australian air and were selling it in China. One of the great marketing plays, that one.
I remember when I was in middle school, it was the Uggs. There was like a huge phase of Uggs being super popular. So like, I think that's another great example of an Aussie brand that did well overseas and really leveraged that Australian marketing in their overseas campaigns.
It's amazing though how many of those companies are not actually owned. They're owned by foreign companies who are obviously using, you know, Australia as the marketing. They just, you know, set up a virtual office here, but you know, they're actually in Texas or Denmark or something.
Yeah.
It's pretty clever ploy that. But let's talk about, so obviously we've established a bit about the business and kind of how it's grown. Can you give us kind of a bit of context to where it is now? You know, you don't have to go into any specific monetary details or anything like that, but how is it kind of, where is it at now?
Yeah, well, especially since COVID started, I mean, a lot of people are shopping online. So we've seen tremendous growth in the last 18, 24 months because of COVID. In terms of scale, we're in the eight figures. So things are growing pretty quickly. We've just recently had to move to a bigger 3PL to handle our order fulfillment. So now we're at a point where it's pretty much, you know, the concept's been proven and it's about getting it on as many people as possible and scaling it and testing out different marketing campaigns. So originally we just started with originally we just started with Facebook and Instagram. And now as the business is starting to mature, we're starting to look at other channels. So we're going to be going hard into YouTube now. We've started advertising on TikTok, which is, you know, a really hot platform, especially for e-commerce right now. And we're looking at starting sort of an influencer, like athlete influencer campaign as well. So yeah, the business has really matured from just pretty much advertising on Facebook at the start of COVID to now really pushing everything in more of an omni-channel marketing approach.
Amazing. So what do you think's been the biggest kind of levers to drive that scale? Obviously, you know, exceptional growth during COVID, but what do you think has been kind of the key drivers?
Yeah, I think it's just consistency. Like every single day I'm working on it, and it's just like I'm doing something every single day. I'm always thinking about it. And the great thing about underwear is it's not just like a one purchase thing. If people like it, guys tend to be quite loyal and they'll just keep on buying the same brand over and over. So you really do get that sort of like that snowball effect. Maybe that's not a good analogy in Australia.
No, but
like
if, yeah,
if you roll a snowball down a hill, it gains momentum. It gets faster and faster. It's just like doing those little things every day and it finally starts to add up. And now like we have an email database of 75,000 emails. We have an SMS database. So like as you slowly start to build, you create a community and an ecosystem where like, you know, it doesn't cost me anything now to send out an SMS. Like Australia Day is coming out. I just sent out an SMS to all our SMS subscribers. Like that costs nothing, but it takes a while to build that database. So I'd say it's just putting in it's hard work. It's putting in the hard work, the hard yards, but like eventually you start to get the momentum. So yeah.
And I can certainly say how much more fun it gets when you have those levers to play with. You know, you really feel like you're in the driver's seat, you know, adjusting things and actually being able to work on strategy as opposed to just like genuine grind, genuine hustle, which is also fun. But for me, it's more fun when you actually have some levers to pull and an audience to work with. And you can move the needle, as you said, by sending an SMS out to the database and things like that become a lot more interesting as you go along, as opposed to, you know, what it's like in the early days, sending an email or an SMS or something out to all 50 of your contacts. It's not as thrilling.
No, it's definitely not. Like I remember being in the garage packing orders, and you know, when you start, it's exciting, right? Because you got orders, you're packing them, but like that gets old pretty quick. But yeah, you have to put in the, I always had a long-term vision. I don't know where this came from, but I always believed that this brand would be successful, partly because like I believe so much in the product and I know that the product is so much better than what else is on the market. So I've always believed in the product. I knew that it was going to be a success. And for me, it was always a matter of time. It's a matter of time. And eventually that momentum was going to start to build. So I think that's a really important key, is to like, find a product that you really believe in, because it makes it so much easier.
Definitely. And what's the I suppose the product is a little bit angled towards, you know, an athletic or sporty kind of vibe. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have two lines. We started out with just one line of underwear. It was made of like a moisture wicking quick dry fabric. So really meant for sports, if you're sweating a lot, if you're in and out of the water, which again really plays into Australia. You know, it's a hot climate here. So that was our first product line. Now we have a bamboo line, which is like a soft, silky fabric, you know, has an environmentally friendly marketing angle that you can play with that. So yeah, we're really starting to expand product line. In terms of like the customers, the great thing about men's underwear is like the end consumer is male. Men actually is quite a large age range. We find anywhere between the ages of 20 to 45, 50 is sort of our main target. But outside of that, like women are big consumers of men's underwear, and the fact that they're buying them for their husbands, their boyfriends, their sons, it's used, you know, it's gifted a lot. I think every guy can attest to getting a pair of undies at Christmas. So in terms of the marketing, we don't just market directly to men. We also have to change the tone and the style of our marketing to include women as well. And so that was something that we learned through the process. It took us a while to figure out, oh, there's actually a lot of women that are buying them, and we should probably shift our marketing to attract that customer as well. So that was another lever that we pulled in the last, you know, 24 months that's we've seen substantial growth. Now we're building landing pages that are specifically targeting women. But yeah, the main consumer is definitely that athletic man. And I think that sort of brings us into like what the brand stands for. The brand is called Sparks Underwear. And the idea is like underwear is the first thing you put on in the morning, the last thing you take off at night. And in between, you know, life happens. So it's just a reminder to do one thing a day that sparks you. So that's sort of portrayed through our marketing, rather than just having like, you know, ripped guys in six packs like Calvin Klein does. The idea was to sort of have that sort of aspirational tone in the marketing. If you go onto the Instagram, you'll sort of get an idea of the vibe of the brand on as sort of, you know, living a life that sparks you.
Love that. And I mean, on the gender split, it's a really interesting one. I think two of my brands, Uncle Jack and Athletic, and I think, you know, if you looked at it from the outside, you'd say, oh, well, that's a male dominated or male centric brand. But when you actually look under the hood, it's actually more female than male. And, you know, look, I don't want to generalize. I think the reality is, in my experience across those two brands, is that men are generally quite lazy shoppers. And I can kind of attest to that myself. Whereas, you know, women generally, I think, do more research on their purchases. I think they're, you know, more likely to look at the details, particularly with something like underwear. You know, you might have a cohort of people who care about the specifications, what material it is it eco-friendly, is it good for sport? And then there's another cohort of customers who are just like, looks good, gonna arrive at my doorstep, bang, done. Yeah, put it on repeat purchase.
That's interesting that you mentioned that, because I also share sort of the same feeling about it. Like, women are so much more open to trying new brands and trying new things. Like, if you look at a guy's closet, you know, say you have your favorite t-shirt, you'll just buy that same t-shirt in a couple different colors. But like a women's closet, there's just so many different brands. Same with like the skincare. So I think they are just more open to trying new brands and experimenting. So we found that a lot of guys, like a lot of women, are buying them for their man, and then their man will come on and be like, they'll buy, since their wife had got them a pair, and they're like, oh, this is actually so much better. And so we found it's like, it's hard to convince guys to buy that first pair, but if they get that first pair in their hands, then the second sale is easy.
For sure. And look, let's leave the gender talk there without a female voice to chime in on this one. But let's talk about the athletes side of it, because that's certainly of interest to me, and certainly, you know, where I've had some experience in building brands around working with athletes. How, you know, we have, as I said at the start of this podcast, we obviously had a chat a few weeks ago about some of the ways to use athletes within a brand. Do you have a bit of an idea about, I suppose, how you want to kind of go about that now?
Yeah, well, I guess let's sort of give the listeners some context as to our conversation. So I had contacted Robbie, a couple of weeks ago. What I had done is I went to my manufacturer and I had a whole bunch of teams from the AFL and the NRL done up, and the underwear was done in the team's colors with the team name on the waistband and the logo on the leg. And my idea at the time was, okay, I'm going to get these team colors done. I'm going to direct message athletes on Instagram and see if they would be interested in working with me and building the brand. But I guess, I didn't have any sort of partnership with the ARL or the NRL. This was just me going out rogue and trying to figure it out myself. So I think athletes are definitely unique influencers in the sense that, like, A, they have a good following. B, people trust them and like them. So as opposed to just like your standard influencer on Instagram, I think there's like more of an innate sense of trust, since like, oh, you know, if they're a professional athlete, they're legit, right? So I think that's what makes athletes, you know, really good influencers, is that there is that sort of innate sense of trust because they are a professional athlete and you know of them. So yeah, that's sort of where the idea started.
Yeah, for sure. And look, I can categorically say that athletes are the best type of influencer, but, you know, and I say this a little bit tongue in cheek, they are the worst type of influencer to work with, because, you know, I think when you look at most influencers that are kind of serious about it, you know, they have a content plan and they're very structured. They'll send you a media kit. They'll have
a dedicated
email. It's their pretty much their full-time job usually. And, you know, then you go across to athletes and, hey, they're actually athletes. You know, their full-time job is being an athlete. And this is just like something, you know, supplementary, or sometimes it's something they don't even care about. It's just something, you know, it's just their personal Instagram or whatever. And they just happen to have a lot of followers. So in terms of communication, in terms of liaising on posts, on product and stuff, is really, really difficult. But in terms of the outcome, this, in my opinion, is the best category there is as far as an influencer goes. And I think in 2022, I think this goes across the board anyway, but the days of just sending product out to an influencer, and hopefully you can attest to this, is kind of gone, because people can see straight through it. Unless you have a particular message or a particular kind of
social cause.
You have to have a story or some kind of emotion behind it for it to be any kind of, have any kind of effectiveness. Otherwise, you're literally just wasting money on postage and product. I think particularly this year, 2022, the way that brands work with influencers, which is a terrible word, really.
Yeah, it does have not a positive connotation to it.
No, correct. Yeah. I'm not sure if there's another term out there, but we'll stick with influencer just for the purpose of this. But look, I think the way brands are going to be working with influencers is going to be super, super different. I think it's going to be more involved. So, you know, I think back to, you know, 2015, 16, 17, you know, you send out a bunch of product to influencers, they'll post and it'll generate some sales. It doesn't work now. There's too many things working against it. You've got the algorithm, you've got the sentiment of the social media community is really aware of product placement in their Instagram feed or whatever feed there is. So I think the way brands are going to be working with, you know, influencers as a whole, but particularly athletes, is going to kind of be the model that we worked on with Uncle Jack in a collaboration sense, but even more in depth is collaborating on product designs. So, you know, teaming up with athletes to create their own custom products within the range or the collection, doing content collaborations. So, you know, I think content now more than ever is so important. I'm not just talking about an Instagram post, but things like, you know, things like this podcast, things like doing interviews or doing a behind the scenes of a day of an athlete sponsored by Sparks. You know, things like that are really important for a brand. So I think we're going to see some really innovative collaborations with influencers beyond the things that we're used to.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think it's too transactional if you're just going to send them something and hope that they post. So I've started to realize that's probably not the best way forward. So yeah, I think you see it, like a lot of brands are doing that now where they're working with the influencer to build a product. Their following will want to buy. I have a question for you, actually. If you were to start again with no network, how would you go about contacting these athletes? Do you think it's better to hit them up on Instagram because they probably have, you know, hundreds of DMs? Or do you think it's better to try a different approach? Like, how would you go about sort of starting to seed product with athletes?
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's something I think about a little bit. And look, I think from an outside perception, you know, you might look at me with this podcast or, you know, the brands working with a lot of athletes and think, oh, well, this guy's really well connected in that space. Well, obviously I have connections in the space because I've been working in it for 7-8 years, but I wouldn't say a lot of them are super strong connections. So yeah, I think there's that perception that, you know, that person has, you know, so many contacts, but how many of them could you actually call upon at a certain time to kind of, and as you say, you don't want to be transactional either. But look, if I was starting from scratch, no contacts, no network, no ins anywhere, you know, you're obviously starting from the bottom, so to speak. It's easy to find players' agents, players' managers. I think that would be the first step. I'm not sure too much about the NRL. I've only worked with a handful of NRL players and not always through agents either. But in the AFL, there's probably, I would say, 5 major player agent groups who kind of have the majority of players. There's certainly a lot. There's probably, I don't know the exact number, there's probably 50 player agent groups. But I would go after sort of 5 or 6, catch up for coffee, say, this is what I'm doing. You know, if you can get a sit down at least, this is what I'm doing. I'm keen to work with, you know, 2 or 3 players that fit this mold, because obviously athletes are just like any other influencer. Not all of them are going to fit your brand's values, or, you know, obviously athletes have their own personalities and their own identities that don't always match every brand, which is a good thing. I think that's something that sport should really let flourish, is the individual personalities of athletes and people in sport, as opposed to...
That's funny that you bring that up, because I've noticed, like, would you say that Australian sports culture has like a tall poppy syndrome?
Look, I know where you're going with this. I know where you're taking it. I would say that, yes.
Because if I look at the most like popular Australian sports stars, I look at someone like Nick Kyrgios, who has a personality, you know, he doesn't just say things by the book, but then he also gets slammed by the media. And like, as a North American, it's funny to see the contrast of cultures between, you know, North American sports culture and Australian sports culture. Even if you're walking around the US, you see athletes postered everywhere, you know, promoting Powerade, promoting any sort of energy drink, like they're all over the place, bus stops. But like here, I think it's more subtle, and I just don't notice it as much.
Yeah. And it's funny because you're so right. We talk about it often in the office about how basically what you just said. But, you know, Australians have a somewhat kind of larrikin culture where you can be, you know, a bit silly, a bit obnoxious at times, and it's funny. But as soon as we see an athlete being a larrikin, you know, in the public eye, we're so quick to tear them down, even though it's so part of the Australian culture. You know, if it's not hurting anyone and no one's saying anything overly controversial, I think that's where Australia has missed that entertainment factor that America has, where they're so good at capitalizing on that commercial aspect of athletes.
Yeah, it's funny, like I find American athletes, they almost play into that, like they know they are the product. And it's interesting, like in Canada, hockey players have like a reputation of just like saying things by the book. So like they're one way in front of the camera, but behind the camera, or like away from the camera, they're like these larger than life personalities. But like in front of the camera, they say what they want, like they say the things by the book, so they don't get in trouble. And it's funny just in Canada to see the difference in culture between like hockey players in the NBA or the NFL, where it's definitely not the case.
Definitely. No, it's super, super interesting, I think.
And even so much like if you look at like a lot of the NBA players or the NFL players, like there's that whole like pre-game, you know, an athlete's walking to the dressing room, there's a camera crew snapping pictures of them, and it's almost like a fashion show, right? And you don't, like, at least I don't see that in Australian sports. It's sort of unique to the US. But I mean, football players in the UK, they're also flashy like that.
Yeah, you often see them, you know, wearing the big bling, walking in with the baggy pants. And yeah, it's a real fashion statement. But I think like one thing I hate about Australian sports consumers, I would call them, is when an athlete does something not related to their sport on the field or on the court, they get slammed. Like, can you just worry about, you know, kicking a goal, or like just worry about hitting the ball? Or like, you know, LeBron built schools for children and, you know, people were slamming him, just like worry about playing basketball. Come on. Like, you know, these are public figures that are doing so much good for the community and providing entertainment. Like during COVID as well, I know a lot of people slammed the fact that sport was able to largely continue during that time. But I know for me, like that was a huge factor, particularly in Melbourne when we were locked down for so long. That's what we looked forward to, you know, at night, just being able to have some entertainment, some sport, because, you know, it's obviously a huge part of, you know, Australian culture.
Yeah, it's funny, even watching the Australian Open the past couple of weeks and seeing the amount of like Nick Kyrgios, I don't even know what he's ranked right now. I don't even think he's in the top 50, but everyone tunes in to watch him because he's entertaining.
Exactly.
And you know he's going to put on a show and he's going to be himself and he's marketable.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think on the other end of the scale is Ash Barty, who is a superstar, who is number one. Amazing, absolutely amazing human, not just a tennis player, unbelievable values, but doesn't have the same marketability as a Kyrgios, from just because of that factor of not being a huge personality on or off the court. So it is really interesting how the athletes actually market themselves. You know, we talked about the US.
Do you think athletes think about that, or you don't think that Australian athletes, as they're beginning their professional career, they think about, how do I want to market myself? Like, what is going to be my, you know, my vibe?
No, I don't think they do. And I wish they did, because it would make our job a lot easier. But, you know, you compare that, I think, to the US, where I think their agents are a lot more commercially minded, whereas here agents are not as much. You know, there's a couple of exceptions with your Ralph Carr types and Dustin Martin, but they're largely related to the on-field stuff, you know, the contracts and that sort of thing. And the marketing side is just kind of whatever comes, they'll kind of say yes or no. Whereas, you know, like there's athletes in the US that are like giving themselves nicknames like the Joker or the Green Machine, or like, it's just awesome. Like if you're a brand and you're working with the Green Machine, you know, you're going to create this awesome like green product. It's like, I can just envision the graphics around it now. So
I think Marshall Lynch, he was a football player for the Seattle Seahawks, and he is a personality, and he'd always eat Skittles on the sideline, like giant bag of Skittles. And of course Skittles comes knocking and he gets a big deal with Skittles. Like just stuff like that. He's a personality, he's marketable, and brands are attracted to that.
It's so good. So good. All right. Well, we've kind of continued this chat on a bit, but I love it and it's good. And I think people listening will really enjoy it as far as, you know, business and sports culture combined together. Patrick, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a pleasure. And congratulations on where you've taken the brand so far. I know it's still early days for you and you've got big plans. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah, it was a great conversation. And if you guys want to find out more, you can go online and check out the brand and sort of watch me grow it to what I think it's capable of, which is, the goal is to be the biggest underwear company in Australia. So Bonds, watch out. Here we come.
Love that. All right. Thanks, mate.
No problem.